offers. I think, he went on, that Mac and the boys know everything that has ever happened in the world, and possibly everything that will happen. I think they survive in this particular world better than other people. In a time when people tear themselves to pieces with ambition and nervousness and covetousness, they are relaxed. All of our so-called successful men are sick men, with bad stomachs and bad souls, but Mac and the boys are healthy and curiously clean. They can do what they want. They can satisfy their appetites without calling them something else. This speech so dried out Doc's throat that he drained his beer glass. He waved two fingers in the air and smiled. There is nothing like that first taste of beer, he said. Richard Frost said, I think they're just like anyone else. They just haven't any money. They could get it, Doc said. They could ruin their lives and get money. Mac has qualities of genius. They're all very clever if they want something. They just know the nature of things too well to be caught in that wanting. If Doc had known of the sadness of Mac and the boys, he wouldn't have made the next statement. But no one had told him about the social pressure that was exerted against the inmates of the palace. He poured beer slowly into his glass. I think I can show you proof, he said. You see how they're sitting facing this way? Well, in about half an hour, the 4th of July parade is going to pass on Lighthouse Avenue. By just turning their heads, they can see it. By standing up, they can watch it. And by walking two short blocks, they can be right beside it. Now, I'll bet you a quart of beer they won't even turn their heads.
Suppose they don't, said Richard Frost. What will that prove?
What will it prove? Cried Doc. Why, just that they know what will be in the parade. They will know that the mayor will ride first in an automobile with bunting streaming from the hood. Next will come Long Bob on his white horse with the flag. Then the city council. Then two companies of soldiers from the Presidio. Next the Elks with purple umbrellas. Then the Knights Templar in white ostrich feathers and carrying swords. Next the Knights of Columbus with red ostrich feathers and carrying swords. Mac and the boys know that. The band will play. They've seen it all. They don't have to look again.
The man doesn't live who doesn't have to look at a parade, said Richard Frost.
Is it a bet, then?
It's a bet. It has always seemed strange to me, said Doc. The things we admire in men, kindness and generosity, openness, honesty, understanding and feeling are the concomitants of failure in our system, and those traits we detest, sharpness, greed, acquisitiveness, meanness, egotism, and self-interest, are the traits of success. And while men admire the quality of the first, they love the produce of the second.
Who wants to be good if he has to be hungry too? Said Richard Frost.
Oh, it isn't a matter of hunger. It's something quite different. The sale of souls to gain the whole world is completely voluntary and almost unanimous, but not quite. Everywhere in the world there are Mac and the boys. I've seen them in an ice cream cellar in Mexico and in an Aleut in Alaska. You know how they tried to give me a party and something went wrong, but they wanted to give me a party. That was their impulse. Listen, said Doc. Isn't that the band I hear?
Quickly he filled two glasses with beer, and the two of them stepped close to the window. Mac and the boys sat dejectedly on their log and faced the laboratory. The sound of the band came from Lighthouse Avenue, the drums echoing back from the buildings, and suddenly the mayor's car crossed, and it sprayed bunting from the radiator. Then Long Bob on his white horse carrying the flag. Then the band, Then the soldiers, the Elks, the Knights Templar, the Knights of Columbus. Richard and the Doc leaned forward tensely, but they were watching the line of men sitting on the log. And not a head turned, not a neck straightened up. The parade filed past, and they did not move. And the parade was gone. Doc drained his glass and waved two fingers gently in the air, and he said, "Ha! There's nothing in the world like that first taste of beer." Richard started for the door. "What kind of beer do you want?" "The same kind," said Doc gently. He was smiling up the hill at Mac and the boys.
It's all fine to say, time will heal everything, this too shall pass away, people will forget, and things like that when you are not involved. But when you are, there is no passage of time. People do not forget, and you are in the middle of something that does not change. Doc didn't know the pain and self-destructive criticism in the palace flophouse, or he might have tried to do something about it. And Mac and the boys did not know how he felt, or they would have held up their heads again. It was a bad time. Evil stalked darkly in the vacant lot. Sam Malloy had a number of fights with his wife, and she cried all the time. The echoes inside the boiler made it sound as though she were crying underwater. Mac and the boys seemed to be the node of trouble. The nice bouncer at the Bear Flag threw out a drunk, but threw him too hard and too far, and broke his back. Alfred had to go over to Salinas 3 times before it was cleared up, and that didn't make Alfred feel very well. Ordinarily, he was too good a bouncer to hurt anyone. His A&C was a miracle of rhythm and grace. On top of that, a group of high-minded ladies in the town demanded that dens of vice must close to protect young American manhood. This happened about once a year in the dead period between the 4th of July and the county fair. Dora usually closed the Bear Flag for a week when it happened. It wasn't so bad. Everyone got a vacation, and little repairs to the plumbing and the walls could be made. But this year, the ladies went on a real crusade. They wanted somebody's scalp. It had been a dull summer, and they were restless. It got so bad that they had to be told who actually owned the property where vice was practiced, what the rents were, and what little hardships might be the result of their closing. That was how close they were to being a serious menace. Dora was closed a full 2 weeks, and there were 3 conventions in Monterey while the Bear Flag was closed. Word got around, and Monterey lost 5 conventions for the following year. Things were bad all over. Doc had to get a loan at the bank to pay for the glass that was broken at the party. Elmer Riccati went to sleep on the Southern Pacific track and lost both legs. A sudden and completely unexpected storm tore a purse seiner and 3 Lampre boats loose from their moorings and tossed them broken and sad on Del Monte Beach. There is no explaining a series of misfortunes like that. Every man blames himself. People in their black minds remember sins committed secretly and wonder whether they have caused the evil sequence. One man may put it down to sunspots, while another, invoking the law of probabilities, doesn't believe it. Not even the doctors had a good time of it, for while many people were sick, none of it was good-paying sickness. It was nothing a good physic or a patent medicine wouldn't take care of. And to cap it all, Darling got sick. She was a very fat and lively puppy when she was struck down, but 5 days of fever reduced her to a little skin-covered skeleton. Her liver-colored nose was pink, and her gums were white. Her eyes glazed with illness, and her whole body was hot, although she trembled sometimes with cold. She wouldn't eat, and she wouldn't drink, and her fat little belly shriveled up against her spine, and even her tail showed the articulations through the skin. It was obviously distemper. Now a genuine panic came over the palace flophouse. Darling had come to be vastly important to them. Huey and Jones instantly quit their jobs so they could be near to help. They sat up in shifts. They kept a cool, damp cloth on her forehead, and she got weaker and sicker. Finally, although they didn't want to, Hazel and Jones were chosen to call on Doc. They found him working over a tide chart while he ate a chicken stew, of which the principal ingredient was not chicken, but sea cucumber. They thought he looked at them a little coldly. "It's Darling," they said. "She's sick." "What's the matter with her?" "Max says it's distemper." "I'm no veterinarian," said Doc. "I don't know how to treat these things." Hazel said, "Well, couldn't you just take a look at her? She's sick as hell." They stood in a circle while Doc examined Darling. He looked at her eyeballs and her gums and felt in her ear for fever. He ran his finger over the ribs that stuck out like spokes and at the poor spine. "She won't eat?" he asked. "Not a thing," said Mac. "You'll have to force feed her. Strong soup and eggs and cod liver oil." They thought he was cold and professional. He went back to his tide charts and his stew. But Mac and the boys had something to do now. They boiled meat until it was as strong as whiskey. They put cod liver oil far back on her tongue so that some of it got down her. They held up her head and made a little funnel of her chops and poured the cool soup in. She had to swallow or drown. Every 2 hours they fed her and gave her water. Before they had slept in shifts. Now no one slept. They sat silently and waited for Darling's crisis. It came early in the morning. The boys sat in their chairs half asleep, but Mac was awake, and his eyes were on the puppy. He saw her ears flip twice, and her chest heave. With infinite weakness, she climbed slowly to her spindly legs, dragged herself to the door, took 4 laps of water, and collapsed on the floor. Mac shouted the others awake. He danced heavily. All the boys shouted at one another. Lee Chong heard them and snorted to himself as he carried out the garbage cans. Alfred the bouncer heard them and thought they were having a party. By 9 o'clock, Darling had eaten a raw egg and half a pint of whipped cream by herself. By noon she was visibly putting on weight. In a day, she romped a little, and by the end of the week, she was a well dog. At last, a crack had developed in the wall of evil. There were evidences of it everywhere. The purse seiner was hauled back into the water and floated. Word came down to Dora that it was all right to open up the bear flag. Earl Wakefield caught a sculpin with 2 heads and sold it to the museum for $8. The wall of evil and of waiting was broken. It broke away in chunks. The curtains were drawn at the laboratory that night, and Gregorian music played until 2 o'clock, and then the music stopped, and no one came out. Some force wrought with Lee Chong's heart, and all in an oriental moment he forgave Mac and the boys and wrote off the frog debt, which had been a monetary headache from the beginning. And to prove to the boys that he had forgiven them, he took a pint of old tennis shoes up and presented it to them. Their trading at the thrift market had hurt his feelings, but it was all over now.
Lee's visit coincided with the first destructive, healthy impulse Darling had since her illness. She was completely spoiled now, and no one thought of housebreaking her. When Lee Chong came in with his gift, Darling was deliberately and happily destroying Hazel's only pair of rubber boots, while her happy masters applauded her. Mac never visited the Bear Flag professionally. It would have seemed a little like incest to him. There was a house out by the baseball park he patronized. Thus, when he went into the front bar, everyone thought he wanted a beer. He stepped up to Alfred.
"Dora around?" he asked.
"What do you want with her?" Alfred asked.
"I got something want to ask her."
"What about?"
"That's none of your goddamn business," said Mac.
"Okay. Have it your way. I'll see if she wants to talk to you." A moment later, he led Mac into the sanctum. Dora sat at a roll-top desk. Her orange hair was piled in ringlets on her head, and she wore a green eyeshade. With a stub pen, she was bringing her books up to date, a fine old double-entry ledger. She was dressed in a magnificent pink silk wrapper with lace at the wrists and throat. When Mac came in, she whirled her pivot chair about and faced him. Alfred stood in the door and waited. Mac stood until Alfred closed the door and left. Dora scrutinized him suspiciously.
"Well, what can I do for you?" she demanded at last.
"You see, ma'am," said Mac, "well, I guess you heard what we done over at Doc's some time back."
Dora pushed the eyeshade back up on her head, and she put the pen in an old-fashioned coil-spring holder.
"Yeah," she said. "I heard."
"Well, ma'am, we did it for Doc. You may not believe it, but we wanted to give him a party. Only he didn't get home in time, and... well, she got out of hand."
"So I heard," said Dora. "Well, what you want me to do?"
"Well," said Mac, "I and the boys thought we'd ask you. You know what we think of Doc. We wanted to ask you what you thought we could do for him that would kind of show him."
Dora said, and she flopped back in her pivot chair and crossed her legs and smoothed her wrapper over her knees. She shook out a cigarette, lighted it, and studied.
"You gave him a party he didn't get to. Why don't you give him a party he does get to?" she said.
"Jesus," said Mac afterwards, talking to the boys. "It was just as simple as that. Now there is one hell of a woman. No wonder she got to be a madam. There is one hell of a woman."
Chapter 24. Mary Talbot, Mrs. Tom Talbot, that is, was lovely. She had red hair with green lights in it. Her skin was golden with a green undercast, and her eyes were green with little golden spots. Her face was triangular, with wide cheekbones, wide-set eyes, and her chin was pointed. She had long dancer's legs and dancer's feet, and she seemed never to touch the ground when she walked. When she was excited, and she was excited a good deal of the time, her face flushed with gold. Her great-great-great-great-great-grandmother had been burned as a witch. More than anything in the world, Mary Talbot loved parties. She loved to give parties, and she loved to go to parties. Since Tom Talbot didn't make much money, Mary couldn't give parties all the time, so she tricked people into giving them. Sometimes she telephoned a friend and said bluntly, "Isn't it about time you gave a party?" Regularly, Mary had 6 birthdays a year, and she organized costume parties, surprise parties, holiday parties. Christmas Eve at her house was a very exciting thing. for Mary glowed with parties. She carried her husband Tom along on the wave of her excitement. In the afternoon, when Tom was at work, Mary sometimes gave tea parties for the neighborhood cats. She set a footstool with doll cups and saucers. She gathered the cats, and there were plenty of them, and then she held long and detailed conversations with them. It was a kind of play she enjoyed very much, a kind of satiric game, and it covered and concealed from Mary the fact that she didn't have very nice clothes, and the Talbots didn't have any money. They were pretty near absolute bottom most of the time, and when they really scraped, Mary managed to give some kind of party. She could do that. She could infect a whole house with gaiety, and she used her gift as a weapon against the despondency that lurked always around outside the house waiting to get in at Tom. That was Mary's job, as she saw it, to keep the despondency away from Tom, because everyone knew he was going to be a great success sometime. Mostly, she was successful in keeping the dark things out of the house, but sometimes they got in at Tom and laid him out. Then he would sit and brood for hours while Mary frantically built up a backfire of gaiety. One time, when it was the first of the month and there were curt notes from the water company and the rent wasn't paid, and a manuscript had come back from Collier's, and the cartoons had come back from the New Yorker, and pleurisy was hurting Tom pretty badly, he went into the bedroom and lay down on the bed. Mary came softly in, for the blue-gray color of his gloom had seeped out under the door and through the keyhole. She had a little bouquet of candy tuft in a collar of paper lace. "Smell," she said, and held the bouquet to his nose. He smelled the flowers and said nothing. "Do you know what day this is?" she asked, and thought wildly for something to make it a bright day. Tom said, "Why don't we face it for once? We're down. We're going under. What's the good kidding ourselves?" "No, we're not," said Mary. "We're magic people. We always have been. Remember that $10 you found in a book? Remember when your cousin sent you $5? Nothing can happen to us." "Well, it has happened," said Tom. "I'm sorry," he said. "I just can't talk myself out of it this time. I'm sick of pretending everything. For once, I'd like to have it real. Just for once." "I thought of giving a little party tonight," said Mary. "On what?" "You're not going to cut out the baked ham picture from a magazine again and serve it on a platter, are you? I'm sick of that kind of kidding. It isn't funny anymore. It's sad." "I could give a little party," she insisted. "Just a small affair. Nobody will dress. It's the anniversary of the founding of the Bloomer League. You didn't even remember that." "It's no use," said Tom. "I know it's mean, but I just can't rise to it. Why don't you just go out and shut the door and leave me alone? I'll get you down if you don't." She looked at him closely and saw that he meant it. Mary walked quietly out and shut the door, and Tom turned over on the bed and put his face down between his arms. He could hear her rustling about in the other room. She decorated the door with old Christmas things, glass balls and tinsel, and she made a placard that said, "Welcome Tom, our hero." She listened at the door and couldn't hear anything. A little disconsolately, she got out the footstool and spread a napkin over it. She put her bouquet in a glass in the middle of the footstool and set out four little cups and saucers. She went into the kitchen, put the tea in the teapot, and set the kettle to boil. Then she went out into the yard. Kitty Randolph was sunning herself by the front fence. Mary said, "Miss Randolph,
I'm having a few friends in to tea, if you would care to come.
Kitty Randolph rolled over languorously on her back and stretched in the warm sun.
Don't be later than 4 o'clock, said Mary. My husband and I are going to the Bloomer League centennial reception at the hotel.
She strolled around the house to the backyard, where the blackberry vines clambered over the fence. Kitty Cassini was squatting on the ground, growling to herself and flickering her tail fiercely.
Mrs. Cassini?
Mary began, and then she stopped, for she saw what the cat was doing. Kitty Cassini had a mouse. She patted it gently with her unarmed paw, and the mouse squirmed horribly away, dragging its paralyzed hind legs behind it. The cat let it get nearly to the cover of the blackberry vines, and then she reached delicately out, and white thorns had sprouted on her jaw. Daintily she stabbed the mouse through the back and drew it wiggling to her, and her tail flicked with tense delight. Tom must have been at least half asleep when he heard his name called over and over. He jumped up, shouting, "What is it? Where are you?" He could hear Mary crying. He ran out into the yard and saw what was happening.
"Turn your head!" he shouted,
and he killed the mouse. Kitty Cassini had leaped to the top of the fence, where she watched him angrily. Tom picked up a rock and hit her in the stomach and knocked her off the fence. In the house, Mary was still crying a little. She poured the water into the teapot and brought it to the table. "Sit there," she told Tom, and he squatted down on the floor in front of the footstool.
"Can't I have a big cup?" he asked.
"I can't blame Kitty Cassini," said Mary. "I know how cats are. It isn't her fault. But, oh, Tom, I'm going to have trouble inviting her again. I'm just not going to like her for a while, no matter how much I want to." She looked closely at Tom and saw that the lines were gone from his forehead and that he was not blinking badly.
"But then I'm so busy with the Bloomer League these days," she said. "I just don't know how I'm going to get everything done."
Mary Talbot gave a pregnancy party that year, and everyone said, "God, a kid of hers is going to have fun."
Chapter 25. Certainly all of Cannery Row, and probably all of Monterey, felt that a change had come. It's all right not to believe in luck and omens. Nobody believes in them, but it doesn't do any good to take chances with them, and no one takes chances. Cannery Row, like every place else, is not superstitious, but will not walk under a ladder or open an umbrella in the house. Doc was a pure scientist, and incapable of superstition, and yet when he came in late one night and found a line of white flowers across the door sill, he had a bad time of it. But most people in Cannery Row simply do not believe in such things, and then live by them. There was no doubt in Mac's mind that a dark cloud had hung on the Palace Flophouse. He had analyzed the abortive party and found that a misfortune had crept into every crevice, that bad luck had come up like hives on the evening, and once you got into a routine like that, the best thing to do was just to go to bed until it was over. You couldn't buck it. Not that Mac was superstitious. Now, a kind of gladness began to penetrate into the row and to spread out from there. Doc was almost supernaturally successful with a series of lady visitors. He didn't half try. The puppy at the palace was growing like a pole bean, and having 1,000 generations of training behind her, she began to train herself. She got disgusted with wetting on the floor and took to going outside.
It was obvious that Darling was going to grow up a good and charming dog, and she had developed no chorea from her distemper. The benignant influence crept like gas through the row. It got as far as Herman's hamburger stand. It spread to the San Carlos Hotel. Jimmy Bruccia felt it, and Johnny, his singing bartender. Sparky Evia felt it, and joyously joined battle with three new out-of-town cops. It even got as far as the county jail in Salinas, where Gay, who had lived a good life by letting the sheriff beat him at checkers, suddenly grew cocky and never lost another game. He lost his privileges that way, but he felt a whole man again. The sea lions felt it, and their barking took on a tone and a cadence that would have gladdened the heart of St. Francis. Little girls studying their catechism suddenly looked up and giggled for no reason at all. Perhaps some electrical finder could have been developed so delicate that it could have located the source of all this spreading joy and fortune, and triangulation might possibly have located it in the Palace Flophouse and Grill. Certainly the palace was lousy with it. Mac and the boys were charged. Jones was seen to leap from his chair only to do a quick tap dance and sit down again. Hazel smiled vaguely at nothing at all. The joy was so general and so suffused that Mac had a hard time keeping it centered and aimed at its objective. Eddie, who had worked at La Ida pretty regularly, was accumulating a cellar of some promise. He no longer added beer to the wining jug. It gave a flat taste to the mixture, he said. Sam Malloy had planted morning glories to grow over the boiler. He had put out a little awning, and under it he and his wife often sat in the evening. She was crocheting a bedspread. The joy even got into the bear flag. Business was good. Phyllis May's leg was knitting nicely, and she was nearly ready to go to work again. Eva Flanagan got back from East St. Louis, very glad to be back. It had been hot in East St. Louis, and it hadn't been as fine as she remembered it. But then she had been younger when she had had so much fun there. The knowledge or conviction about the party for Doc was no sudden thing. It did not burst out full-blown. People knew about it, but let it grow gradually, like a pupa in the cocoons of their imaginations. Mac was realistic about it. "Last time we forced her," he told the boys. "You can't never give a good party that way. You gotta let her creep up on you." "Well, when's it gonna be?" Jones asked impatiently.
"I don't know," said Mac.
"Is it gonna be a surprise party?"
Hazel asked.
"It ought to. That's the best kind," said Mac.
Darling brought him a tennis ball she had found, and he threw it out the door into the weeds. She bounced away after it. Hazel said,
"If we knew when was Doc's birthday, we could give him a birthday party."
Mac's mouth was open. Hazel constantly surprised him.
"By God, Hazel, you got something," he cried.
"Yes, sir. If it was his birthday, there'd be presents. That's just the thing. All we gotta find out is when it is."
"That ought to be easy," said Huey. "Why don't we ask him?"
"Hell," said Mac. "Then he'd catch on. You ask a guy when is his birthday, and especially if you've already given him a party like we done, and he'll know what you want to know for.
Maybe I'll just go over and smell around a little and not let on."
"I'll go with you," said Hazel. "No, if two of us went, he might figure we were up to something."
"Well, hell, was my idea," said Hazel.
"I know," said Mac, "and when it comes off, while I'll tell Doc it was your idea. But I think I better go over alone."
"How is he? Friendly?" Eddie asked.
Sure, he's all right.
Mac found Doc way back in the downstairs part of the laboratory. He was dressed in a long rubber apron, and he wore rubber gloves to protect his hands from the formaldehyde. He was injecting the veins and arteries of small dogfish with color mass. His little ball mill rolled over and over, mixing the blue mass. The red fluid was already in the pressure gun. Doc's fine hands worked precisely, slipping the needle into place and pressing the compressed air trigger that forced the color into the veins. He laid the finished fish in a neat pile. He would have to go over these again to put blue mass in the arteries. The dogfish made good dissection specimens.
"Hi, Doc," said Mac. "Keeping pretty busy?"
"Busy as I want," said Doc. "How's the pup?"
"Doing just fine. She would have died if it hadn't been for you."
For a moment, a wave of caution went over Doc and then slipped off. Ordinarily, a compliment made him wary. He had been dealing with Mac for a long time, but the tone had nothing but gratefulness in it. He knew how Mac felt about the pup.
"How are things going up at the palace?"
"Fine, Doc, just fine. We got 2 new chairs. I wish you'd come up and see us. It's pretty nice up there now."
"I will," said Doc. "Eddie still bring back the jug?"
"Sure," said Mac. "He ain't putting beer in it no more, and I think the stuff is better. It's got more zip."
"It had plenty of zip before," said Doc.
Mac waited patiently. Sooner or later, Doc was going to wade into it, and he was waiting. If Doc seemed to open the subject himself, it would be less suspicious. This was always Mac's method.
"Haven't seen Hazel for some time. He isn't sick, is he?"
"No," said Mac, and he opened the campaign.
"Hazel is all right. Him and Huey are having one hell of a battle. Been going on for a week," he chuckled. "And the funny thing is, it's about something they don't neither of them know nothing about. I stayed out of it because I don't know nothing about it neither. But not them. They've even got a little mad at each other."
"What's it about?" Doc asked.
"Well, sir," said Mac, "Hazel's all the time buying these here charts and looking up lucky days and stars and stuff like that. And Huey says it's all a bunch of malarkey. Hazel, he says, if you know when a guy is born, you can tell about him. And Huey says they're just selling Hazel them charts for 2 bits apiece. Me, I don't know nothing about it. What do you think, Doc?"
"I'd kind of side with Huey," said Doc. He stopped the ball mill, washed out the color gun, and filled it with blue mass.
"They got going hot the other night," said Mac. "They ask me when I'm born, so I tell 'em April 12th. And Hazel, he goes and buys one of them charts and read all about me. Well, it did seem to hit in some places, but it was nearly all good stuff, and a guy'll believe good stuff about himself. It said I'm brave and smart and kind to my friends, but Hazel says it's all true. When's your birthday, Doc?"
At the end of the long discussion, it sounded perfectly casual. You couldn't put your finger on it, but it must be remembered that Doc had known Mac a very long time. If he had not, he would have said December 18th, which was his birthday, instead of October 27th, which was not.
"October 27th, said Doc.
"Ask Hazel what that makes me."
"It's probably so much malarkey," said Mac. "But Hazel, he takes it serious. I'll ask him to look you up, Doc."
When Mac left, Doc wondered casually what the build-up was, for he had recognized it as a lead. He knew Mac's technique, his method. He recognized his style, and he wondered to what purpose Mac could put the information.
It was only later, when rumors began to creep in, that Doc added the whole thing up. Now he felt slightly relieved, for he had expected Mac to put the bite on him.
Chapter 26. The two little boys played in the boatworks yard until a cat climbed the fence. Instantly they gave chase, drove it across the tracks, and there filled their pockets with granite stones from the roadbed. The cat got away from them in the tall weeds, but they kept the stones because they were perfect in weight, shape, and size for throwing. You can't ever tell when you're going to need a stone like that. They turned down Cannery Row and wanged a stone at the corrugated iron front of Morton's Cannery. A startled man looked out the office window and then rushed for the door, but the boys were too quick for him. They were lying behind a wooden stringer in the lot before he even got near the door. He couldn't have found them in 100 years.
"I bet he could look all his life and he couldn't find us," said Joey.
They got tired of hiding after a while with no one looking for them. They got up and strolled on down Cannery Row. They looked a long time in Lee's window, coveting the pliers, the hacksaws, the engineer's caps, and the bananas. Then they crossed the street and sat down on the lower step of the stairs that went to the second story of the laboratory. Joey said,
"You know, this guy in here got babies in bottles."
"What kind of babies?" Willard asked.
"Regular babies, only before they're born."
"I don't believe it," said Willard.
"Well, it's true. The Sprague kid's seen them, and he says they ain't no bigger than this, and they got little hands and feet and eyes."
"And hair?" Willard demanded.
"Well, the Sprague kid didn't say about hair."
"You should have asked him. I think he's a liar."
"You better not let him hear you say that," said Joey.
"Well, you can tell him I said it. I ain't afraid of him, and I ain't afraid of you. I ain't afraid of anybody. You want to make something of it?"
Joey didn't answer.
"Well, do you?"
"No," said Joey.
"I was thinking, why don't we just go up and ask the guy if he got babies in bottles? Maybe he'd show them to us. That is, if he's got any."
"He ain't here," said Willard. "When he's here, his car's here. He's away someplace. I think it's a lie. I think the Sprague kid is a liar. I think you're a liar. You want to make something of that?"
It was a lazy day. Willard was going to have to work hard to get up any excitement.
"I think you're a coward, too. You want to make something of that?"
Joey didn't answer. Willard changed his tactics.
"Where's your old man now?" he asked in a conversational tone.
"He's dead," said Joey.
"Oh, yeah? I didn't hear. What'd he die of?"
For a moment, Joey was silent. He knew Willard knew, but he couldn't let on he knew, not without fighting Willard, and Joey was afraid of Willard.
He killed himself."
"Yeah?" Willard put on a long face.
"How'd he do it?"
"He took rat poison." Willard's voice shrieked with laughter.
"What'd he think? He was a rat?"
Joey chuckled a little at the joke. Just enough, that is.
"He must have thought he was a rat," Willard cried. "Did he go crawling around like this? Look, Joey, like this? Did he wrinkle up his nose like this? Did he have a big old long tail?"
Willard was helpless with laughter.
"Why didn't he just get a rat trap and put his head in it?"
They laughed themselves out on that one. Willard really wore it out. Then he probed for another joke.
"What did he look like when he took it? Like this?"
He crossed his eyes and opened his mouth and stuck out his tongue.
"He was sick all day," said Joey. "He didn't die till the middle of the night. It hurt him."
Willard said,
"What'd he do it for?"
"He couldn't get a job," said Joey.
Nearly a year he couldn't get a job. And you know a funny thing? The next morning a guy come around to give him a job.
Willard tried to recapture his joke.
I guess he just figured he was a rat, he said. But it fell through, even for Willard.
Joey stood up and put his hands in his pockets. He saw a little coppery shine in the gutter and walked toward it, but just as he reached it, Willard shoved him aside and picked up the penny.
I saw it first, Joey cried. It's mine. You want to try and make something of it, said Willard. Why don't you go take some rat poison?
Chapter 27 Mac and the Boys. The Virtues, the Beatitudes, the Beauties. They sat in the palace flophouse, and they were the stone dropped in the pool, the impulse which sent out ripples to all of Cannery Row and beyond, to Pacific Grove, to Monterey, even over the hill to Carmel. This time, said Mac, we got to be sure he gets to the party. If he don't get there, we don't give it. Where are we going to give it this time? Jones asked. Mac tipped his chair back against the wall and hooked his feet around the front legs.
I've give that a lot of thought, he said. Of course, we could give it here, but it would be pretty hard to surprise him here. And Doc likes his own place. He's got his music there.
Mac scowled around the room.
I don't know who broke his phonograph last time, he said. But if anybody so much as lays a finger on it next time, I personally will kick the hell out of him.
I guess we'll just have to give it at his place, said Huey.
People didn't get the news of the party. The knowledge of it just slowly grew up in them. And no one was invited. Everyone was going. October 27th had a mental red circle around it, and since it was to be a birthday party, there were presents to be considered. Take the girls at Dora's. All of them had at one time or another gone over to the laboratory for advice or medicine or simply for unprofessional company. And they had seen Doc's bed. It was covered with an old faded red blanket full of foxtails and burrs and sand, for he took it on all his collecting trips. If money came in, he bought laboratory equipment. It never occurred to him to buy a new blanket for himself. Dora's girls were making him a patchwork quilt, a beautiful thing of silk. And since most of the silk available came from underclothing and evening dresses, the quilt was glorious in strips of flesh pink and orchid and pale yellow and cerise. They worked on it in the late mornings and in the afternoons before the boys from the sardine fleet came in. Under the community of effort, those fights and ill feelings that always are present in a whorehouse completely disappeared. Lee Chong got out and inspected a 25-foot string of firecrackers and a big bag of China lily bulbs. These, to his way of thinking, were the finest things you could have for a party. Sam Malloy had long had a theory of antiques. He knew that old furniture and glass and crockery, which had not been very valuable in its day, had, when time went by, taken on desirability and cash value out of all proportion to its beauty or utility. He knew of one chair that had brought $500. Sam collected pieces of historic automobiles, and he was convinced that someday his collection, after making him very rich, would repose on black velvet in the best museums. Sam gave the party a good deal of thought, and then he went over his treasures, which he kept in a big locked box behind the boiler. He decided to give Doc one of his finest pieces, the connecting rod and piston from a 1916 Chalmers. He rubbed and polished this beauty until it gleamed like a piece of ancient armor. He made a little box for it and lined it with black cloth. Mac and the boys gave the problem considerable thought and came to the conclusion that Doc always wanted cats and had some trouble getting them. Mac brought out his double cage. They borrowed a female in an interesting condition and set their trap under the cypress tree at the top of the vacant lot. In the corner of the palace, they built a wire cage, and in it their collection of angry tomcats grew with every night. Jones had to make 2 trips a day to the canneries for fish heads to feed their charges. Mac considered, and correctly, that 25 tomcats would be as nice a present as they could give Doc. "No decorations this time," said Mac. "Just a good, solid party with lots of liquor." Gay heard about the party clear over in Salinas jail, and he made a deal with the sheriff to get off that night and borrowed $2 from him for a round-trip bus ticket. Gay had been very nice to the sheriff, who wasn't a man to forget it, particularly because election was coming up and Gay could, or said he could, swing quite a few votes. Besides, Gay could give the Salinas jail a bad name if he wanted to. Henri had suddenly decided that the old-fashioned pincushion was an art form which had flowered and reached its peak in the 90s and had since been neglected. He revived the form and was delighted to see what could be done with colored pins. The picture was never completed. You could change it by rearranging the pins. He was preparing a group of these pieces for a one-man show when he heard about the party, and he instantly abandoned his own